Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a show by, for, and about young people. It airs on the first Sunday of each month from 3 to 4 p.m. and is hosted by young people in Mendocino County. We want to create a place where young people can talk truthfully about important issues in our lives and have a dialogue with the community of listening and listeners. Today's hosts are me, Talon from Laytonville High School, and
Royce from Willits High School,
and Teo from Laytonville High School.
Today our topic is harm reduction and zero tolerance. Harm reduction is a set of policy beliefs, essentially stating that some people always have and always will perform activities, such as drug use, that may cause them harm. Therefore, the best method that will reduce the harm caused by risky activities should be adopted, rather than an ineffectual blanket of prohibition of the performance of harmful activities.
Harm reduction has been applied to activities other than drugs, such as mandatory seatbelt and helmet laws, laws controlling smoking in public, encouragement of the use of water pipes as opposed to cigarettes and straight pipes, sex education classes, not notifying parents about their children receiving contraception, not notifying parents for youth abortions. All of these initiatives aim to reduce the harm that may be caused by risky activities.
We will begin today's show by listening to an interview recorded in 2001 for Youth Speaks Out. Jack was asking questions about harm reduction to Callie Sham DeVito, a drug counselor who is working the local schools. Here's the interview.
Hi, my name's Jack, and we're here today talking with Callie Sham DeVito, and I'm going to be interviewing him on harm reduction, how it works, and how it would work if implied in our school district.
This is Callie Sham DeVito. I'm a psychotherapist working locally, and I'm going to be talking about harm reduction and my experiences and understanding of harm reduction with Jack.
Callie Sham, a lot of us out there don't really know a lot about what harm reduction is, so could you just start off explaining a little bit about it and what you know?
I think the simplest way I can explain in my own words is that harm reduction refers to measures aimed at reducing the harm associated with drug use without necessarily requiring a reduction in consumption of the drugs. There's a few key aspects. One is that from a harm reduction perspective, I accept the user's decision to use. The second piece is that I treat this person with dignity as a human being. And by the same token, that person respects the laws. And thirdly, I guess, that it's neutral regarding long-term goals of intervention, as I'm a counselor, so I don't have an agenda when I meet with somebody about what their long-term goals are in terms of their drug use.
Okay, well, I've heard a lot of people say that harm reduction in many ways promotes drug use. What are your feelings about that?
I think there's, you know, people are going to do what they want to do. I think what is important is that we provide accurate information. And allow people to make decisions on their own. Certainly, there's some times when things are out of control and there may be stronger interventions that are necessary.
Do you have any ideas on how harm reduction originated?
My understanding for this country is that it came into wider use practice in the 1980s in the context of the HIV disease epidemic and also the failure of drug treatment and 12-step programs.
What got you interested in harm reduction?
My experience in the Bay Area working with folks that were chemically dependent, drug addicted to speed and homeless and have health concerns such as HIV and HCV, hepatitis C virus, taught me that when so many complex things are going on in a person's life, there's often prioritizing that needs to happen. And often the programs that I was working for would require abstinence in order to address issues of maybe housing or health. And I learned that it was an obstacle. It was a high threshold to receiving services.
How does harm reduction differ or relate to 12-step programs?
I would say that 12-step is a choice on a menu in harm reduction philosophy. often when people start looking at their drug use, end up choosing abstinence as their goal. And 12-step processes can serve to support that goal. I think how it can hinder the exploration is that you either choose abstinence now or you can't participate. I think that's where it gets to be difficult.
What do you think are some problems with choosing abstinence now?
It depends on, I don't necessarily see it as a problem. It has to be something that the person really wants for themselves. And unless they're ready to go to a place of abstinence, it's going to be an outside agenda. So I don't know if you're asking me something else.
Do you think that 12-step programs are one-sided?
I would say that they can be limited. But, you know, different communities and different meetings, how they're run, that has to be taken into consideration. So I would say that there's definitely a continuum of openness to meeting people where they're at within 12-step process groups. I wouldn't say that, you know, they're all closed.
Does law enforcement or the juvenile justice system know anything about harm reduction? And if so, how do they treat it?
Well, clearly we're moving toward a more compassionate understanding of drug use from a political standpoint, from a legal standpoint, with Prop 36. I think there's a long way to go, and I think that clearly drug users are criminalized. And I don't believe that drug use has many reasons. It could be a symptom of pain management. It could be a mental health issue that's going on. It could be recreational. So I think from my perspective and the role that I work in is I want to know what's happening and what's going on. And I think that the law enforcement agencies don't take the time or even have the time to really tease out or be curious about maybe the underlying issues that are going on.
Yeah. Do you think they treat it more as a moral or legal issue?
It seems so. I mean, I know there's a lot of good folks, lots of good folks that, you know, work in law enforcement. So I don't want to demonize the law enforcement. I don't know if they have the support or training to empathize with what's happening for folks when they use drugs or when they come into their jurisdiction for whatever reason, whether they're breaking the law or they're busted because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Do you think law enforcement should be required to take this training?
I think that it would be helpful to expand the paradigm of what is currently taking place.
Do you think harm reduction programs would work if applied to a high school environment?
I think that how harm reduction can come into a high school situation is first slowly and two, through education, providing accurate information about drugs, various drugs and their effects, both on the body and the mind and the spirit. So youth are informed consumers, so they have access to informed choices.
What do you think is wrong with the drug education system today? Besides not existing,
I don't know if I can fully answer that. I'm going to go back to my feelings about relationships. What's necessary is to engage all people, regardless of age, in conversation about what their concerns are and what's the quality of life they hope to have, and that may include drug use. It may not include drug use, but I think part of drug education entails real relationship and engaging people in a non-judgmental conversation, in addition to, you know, bestowing people with accurate information about drug use and its effects, and also combination of drugs.
In harm reduction, I hear a lot about risk and harms. Could you explain the difference between a risk and a harm?
One puts themselves at risk for overdose when they use many different drugs in a short amount of time. So if somebody is using speed and LSD and alcohol and marijuana all within, you know, a 24-hour period at the same time, there's certainly a risk for overdose. Whether or not somebody does overdose, I can't predict necessarily, but there is certainly a risk of overdosing with using all of those drugs at one time. So the harm would be the actual overdose.
Do you see any relationships with the apparent increase in violence with drug use?
That's a big question.
Or race and drug use.
I think the degree of violence in our culture has to do with the culture's belief about using anger as a way of communicating. About it has a lot, everything to do with race and class and homophobia, ideas about masculinity, gender, socialization. And I believe that drug use intensifies those issues, but I would not say that drug use is a reason for violence. I would say it's about our beliefs about violence and our beliefs about how to interact.
Do you think there's a such thing as safe drug use?
Oh, yeah, sure. Of course there is. You know, people who have a drink or two or whatever their drug of choice is and don't drive. You know, they have a designated driver. That's harm reduction. You know, waiting until the alcohol use is, you know, alcohol is out of your system so you're alert and you're not under the influence and then get in the car. That's harm reduction.
It's also a risk.
Getting in the car, right. That's why we wear safety belts, which is also a harm reduction practice.
What overall steps would someone take besides forming a relationship to reduce the overall consumption of drugs?
I think that the relationship is everything. So that's a big piece of it for me. Long-term abstinence, necessarily a goal of harm reduction. It may be the goal of the person that's coming in for help or that, you know, I'm educating. But it's not necessarily a goal of harm reduction. There's a term that I hold in my head, which is called recovery readiness, meaning that it's a process and it may take a long time for someone to get to a place where they have decided, based on their experiences and based on what they've explored and based on what they've experienced with their drug use, that they don't want to use in the way that they've been using. And that may look like abstinence, it may look like social use and recreational use.
So the person ultimately has to make the choice for themselves?
Right. Right. And so how I work is helping people to find those choices.
Meet them where they're at.
Meet them where they're at.
Is there a conflict between the zero tolerance policies in schools and harm reduction? And if so, how does the school administration treat it?
I think whatever the context, whether it's one's own home or whether it's a school or whether it's a community center, that agency has to be really clear about its boundaries. What they are willing to work with or tolerate, that has to be clear. And we all have the right to make those boundaries. I think how a zero tolerance may have a deleterious effect is that people fall through the cracks. If there was a safety net for someone to maybe chill out while they were coming down at a particular place, whether it was an agency or a school, that might allow them to be off the streets, so it would reduce the risk of being arrested. I think that zero tolerance can be an obstacle for people asking and getting the help they need, regardless of the context. It could be a community mental health organization. It could be a school. It could be someone's own home. It's a clear shutdown of a conversation that could possibly happen. And at the same time, a school or a community mental health center or whatever needs to be very clear about what they're comfortable with and what they're willing to work with. But, you know, at the same time, people fall through the cracks. There's people that are committed to their drug use for a long time, and there's going to be drug use in the future. So how, as a society, how do we meet those people? You know, how do we engage with them? Not as other, but as a part of ourselves, as part of the community.
Do you find it harder to work with teenagers than adults?
In terms of
getting them to open up and be able to form a relationship? Because, I mean, I think kids would be less likely or be more restrainive and hold back than adults?
Well, my experience has shown me that most often that I'm working, not all the time, but most often the reason why someone is in my office, a youth is in my office, is because they've been referred to me and not because they are coming in and seeking my support. So right there, that's, you know, for the context that I'm in, that's a setup.
What do you think would make people not want to come in and seek help on their own?
Well, I imagine the assumption is that they feel they're going to be shamed, judged, punished in some way.
How could we make it clear to people that they're not going to be judged or shamed? Because everybody has it built in their heads that drugs are bad.
Right.
I mean, so if someone has a problem, how are they supposed to get help?
For me, that's an ongoing open question. I think as a society, we need to look at our beliefs about drugs first. You know, I mean, I'm sure the same people that are saying drugs are bad use some form of drugs in their life. Yeah, so I think there has to be an ongoing discussion about, you know, what drugs really are and at what point do they become harmful.
When do you think drug education should start?
I could say where it should start, and that's, you know, based in the family. Whatever, in the broadest sense of the term family, I think that's drug use is their beliefs about what drugs mean. And especially when I was young, you know, my beliefs came solely from my family. So I think there has to be a clear understanding of what that is and respect for those. And it's going to be different across families, you know, earlier than later. It's going to look differently at different ages because, you know, as people, we're able to understand different sorts of information and complexity of information at different levels in different ways. You know, so, you know, a 5-year-old isn't going to understand the same thing that a 10 or a 16-year-old is able to absorb. So it has to be age-appropriate education, but I would say earlier than later.
Mm-hmm. Teens that are referred to you by courts, say if someone doesn't want help, but you think they need help, how would you go about making it clear to them that they do need help?
In the course of a conversation, if someone clearly has serious drug-related harms going on in their life, I would point those out to them and, you know, and say, you know, and compassionately and gently say, you know, this is what I hear. This is what I see based on what you're telling me and what you're sharing about, you know, your drug use and your life. This is what I see, what's going on. And I would mirror back the consequences that I hear that are happening and negative consequences that are, and also positive consequences. Sometimes people's, even if in the midst of chaotic drug use, there's some positive consequences going on. But I think the ultimate step is, and it may take a long time, but or it's going to vary with people. The first step is that the other person, is going to have to say, yeah, that's a concern for me. I'm concerned about, you know, those consequences.
Thank you very much, Kali Tommy. You provided us some great information.
Okay, thanks.
Wow. And we're back. I'm Royce from Willits High School.
I'm Talon from Laytonville High School.
And Teo from Laytonville High School.
That was an interview that Jack did in 2001 with Kelly Sham DeVito on harm reduction. Jack was a student at Willits High School, and Kelly was a psychotherapist working with the local schools in drug counseling. Even though this recording is 13 years old, it sounded pretty relevant to the situation today. Maybe more relevant since the probability is that California will legalize recreational marijuana use within a few years, like Washington and Colorado have already done. While there has never been a shortage of marijuana in our region, the normalization of its use will make it even more available to young people.
Kali defined harm reduction as decreasing the damage that would be caused by substance use, without requiring complete abstinence. The key is accepting the user's decision to use, but helping them to recognize where it is creating conflict for themselves or others. Youth Speaks Out has presented several programs about how marijuana, alcohol, and other drugs affect the development of the adolescent brain. Occasional light use of substances will not cause serious impediments to brain development. Continued use of marijuana or alcohol by adolescents will probably inhibit learning abilities. Heavy use of alcohol can easily lead to serious car accidents, physical or sexual assaults, and unprotected sex. If youth are going to experiment with these substances that the adult population uses, they deserve to be informed so as to reduce the potential harm. Let's talk a bit about what we know about harm reduction and if we think that it is an adequate way to deal with the substance among youth people.
Okay. Well, when it comes to harm reduction, that can be a wide variety of things, you see. Harm reduction can generally apply to almost anything, because almost anything can be harmful to yourself, you know? But really with this, it comes down to certain key things that we've recognized as society to be incredibly harmful to ourselves, as individuals, as a whole, as units, you know? And chief among these are drug abuse. Along with these are social outbursts, anything that can actually harm those around you or yourself. Then it comes down to how to reduce the harm. And with that, anything that might actually reduce harm to yourself or others would be harm reduction, correct? But, Royce...
Well, what I like to think about when we're talking about harm reduction is like a stove. Yeah. You use stoves for like cooking and everyday things. But if you touch the stove, you get burnt. So what do? You tell people not to touch the stove, so therefore you don't get burnt. But people are gonna still use their stoves. What I like about harm reduction is that it focuses on the person, and it's not about like prior or current circumstances or like the culture around them. It just focuses on like the best way to promote the safety and well-being of the person, and I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, most certainly. Dale?
Yeah, it's like, you know, with drugs, you do drugs. It's not just the drugs that is harming you; it's the attitude that's around the drugs. Let's say, you know, with hallucinogens, doing a hallucinogen by yourself or with other people who are on hallucinogens is really dangerous. And therefore, if you're going to do a hallucinogen, you should do it with somebody who's done a hallucinogen before but is, you know, not on a hallucinogen or any other drug, so that they can make sure you don't do something stupid like step off of your roof.
Yeah.
Or, you know, help you talk through things if you have a bad trip. The idea is to create an environment that is safe for the person, so that if they do the drug, it's the drug that's the only thing that could possibly harm them is the drug, not, you know, things that happen around them.
Yeah, so you just create a safe place, you go around safe people, and you keep only a safe amount, you see. So that's a perfect example of harm reduction. But then it comes to the thing where even if you warn somebody, what if they just continue to do it anyways? Now, with that harm reduction, warnings are beautiful, but if you just put a label on a packet of cigarettes, nobody's going to look at the label, nobody's going to care about the label, nobody cares about it. And anybody who smokes will just go in and buy the cigarettes anyways. Now, if you were to, say, show them pictures of lungs after they are, like, disease-ridden, you know, cancerous tumors everywhere, just black, charred black, maybe that would change their mind, you know? Just a little bit.
It's like three X's on the bottle of booze and like cartoons. This is poisonous; it kills you.
Well, that's how many times the moonshine has been distilled.
Yeah,
I didn't actually know that. Yeah. It's like the person's gonna do this, and you can't stop them. But hey, if this person's gonna go, I don't know, go do LSD, you can give them like a nice couch to sit on, a nice
cat head.
A nice area, a safe area for them to do this drug. That's reducing their harm rather than letting them do it outside and end up sitting underneath their truck eating dirt for the next hour or two.
Yeah, and keep it a very limited amount, you know. Control it. It's a controlled substance. Control it, you know. I mean, if you're going to have it, only have a little bit. Don't have enough to where you could actually take enough to OD. you know, stash it away. Some place that you can't find it. Yeah.
Stash the drugs.
Be smart. Use your brain. Think about it.
Yeah, so you don't have to use it when you're on drugs. Anyways, harm reduction isn't limited to substance use. The use of seatbelts was mentioned in the interview. And we can add to that the restrictions on public cigarette smoking to protect people from secondhand smoke, the distribution of condoms to prevent the spread of STDs, and warning labels on food, alcohol, and pharmaceuticals. Harm reduction is being applied to many aspects of our society. Clearly, people who regularly consume cigarettes are not spending time seriously contemplating the warning labels on the packages. Millions of people have received traffic fines for failure to use their seatbelts. So it seems that attempts at harm reduction are not necessarily effective.
Another method of changing behaviors is employing the practice of zero tolerance. Zero tolerance in schools is a policy of punishing any infraction of a rule, regardless of accidental mistakes, ignorance, or extenuating circumstances. In schools, common zero tolerance policies concern possessions of or use of illicit drugs or weapons. Zero tolerance disciplinary policies are often the first step in a child's journey through the school-to-prison pipeline. A study by the National Education Policy Center found that zero-tolerance policies across the nation were increasing suspension rates, with students accused of nonviolent offenses such as dress code violations, cell phone use, and insubordination. They found that zero-tolerance policies put children on a path of truancy and likely incarceration.
In 2010, suspension rates in California schools were compared by county by the California Department of Education. Mendocino County had the highest suspension rate in the state, at a whopping 39%. The suspension rate is the number of suspensions divided into the total number of students. Since you can be suspended more than once in a year, this 39% is not the percentage of students suspended. Still, Mendocino County had the highest rate of suspension in the state. In response to this, to the epidemic of suspensions and expulsions in California, in 2012, California Assembly passed bills allowing alternate means of correction instead of expulsion or suspension. In some cases, it also stated that possession of over-the-counter drugs, a student's prescription drugs, or an imitation firearm is not automatically require expulsion. Let's talk for a while about zero tolerance. Is it in practice in our schools? What kind of atmosphere does it create?
Yeah. So, Royce?
Yes. yes, it's present in our schools. I found it pretty crazy. We were talking about this earlier, that before the 2012, where they passed, this California Assembly passed the bill, which allowed alternative means of corrections. It said that we weren't allowed to have prescription drugs, or not even that, like
Advil
or like ibuprofen, stuff you can pick up at the Dollar Tree that if they found on you, they could potentially suspend you for, which is pretty crazy. But in some places, I support zero tolerance for sure. Like, if there's, like, firearms on school campus, you should definitely be suspended, if not expelled for that, because that is a no-no. That is not keeping...
big no-no.
That is not keeping the school area safe, and that could be linked in with harm reduction.
Yeah, definitely. But then it comes down to some zero tolerant things, they're illogical. You see, they have these automatically set up suspensions for, say you bring, just say you're being disruptive, okay? They automatically suspend you because you're being disruptive. Now, you're being disruptive because perhaps you need attention, perhaps you actually want, like, help, perhaps you need something, and instead of actually giving you help or seeing what it is that you need, I mean, perhaps your principal will take you in and talk to you and say, hey, why did you do this? But generally speaking, you know, they'll suspend you. And you won't get the help you need. So where does this lead? It doesn't lead anywhere. I mean, it's just you going home because you got in trouble. And it doesn't help at all. So what is it?
I find that a lot of the time when someone's suspended and commonly suspended in school that they just simply don't care. The teacher or the principal or somebody, they use the suspension as a threat, and they look at them, they're like, I don't care. You know how many times I've been suspended? I'll just go home and hang out.
Yeah, they're like, just going
to
go home.
It's literally nothing to me. I've been suspended before. This is fine with me.
You know, and kids will like brag about it. Yeah, man, I got suspended for a week last week. It was, you know, pretty great. I didn't do anything. I just kind of stayed at home, sat on the couch, ate Cheetos, and watched TV all day. Yeah, my parents were a little ticked off, but I told them it's all good, so.
And we look at them, we're like, wow, man, I want to get suspended. I'm going to sit on the couch, eat Cheetos.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cheetos are pretty good, man. I don't know. But then it goes beyond this, after all. There's zero tolerance when it comes to those things, but it's also it also goes down to, like, they're just prepping you to go to prison. I mean, all they're doing is making it to where you're ready to go to prison, you know? You get a little bit of a slap on the wrist, but then when you go to prison, they're spending $65,000 a year on a singular inmate. They get 3 meals a day, and they get a nice place to sleep. I mean, of course, not everything in prison's all right. I mean, of course, everyone hears terrible things that go down in prisons. But it does give you a place to sleep, food to eat. Some people don't even have that much when they live outside of prison. So some people just aim to get into prison so that they don't actually have to apply themselves outside of it. Now, before the show, Dan brought up a great point. I think it was Switzerland. Their prison system, they put you in an apartment with TV and you know, accessories, you know, not nice things. It's a nice apartment. It's not bad. And they provide you with a counselor. Now, the counselor asks you and tells you that what you're doing isn't right and asks you, like, why it is that you did it. And, you know, they counsel you. They help you. And isn't that more what our prison system should be doing? Isn't that more what our school should be doing? They shouldn't be looking to just punish people, because most of the time the punishments aren't punishments. But they should also be caring about, like, why it is that you did the thing and what it is that's causing it and what they can do to help you not do it. But they don't help you with that.
Yeah, it's our school systems are confused about what to do, since there are multiple situations with different people. There definitely are kids who, you know, oh, I don't care, I'm just gonna, you know, I don't know, snort some cocaine behind the school, and it's like, you know, they'll do whatever they want to, and they don't care, and they don't follow instructions, and they really don't care about the future of their life. And those are kids, there really are problems. There's not much you can do. Like, you try to help them, and they ignore you, and there's a point where, you know, the school system has to be like, we need to stop, but it shouldn't be their automatic response to everything. They should definitely try other tactics and work towards making people better individuals and helping them succeed in life, you know, go through college, you know, come out with a degree, you know, make money, be happy. You know, the things, but you really, if you just get people in trouble, you don't explain to them why, what they need to do to better, you know, how to help them, they just keep on digging.
And like you said, this circle of, like, punishment keeps happening, and it's the only thing they know, and the only thing that they're used to. And when they get out of high school, what's the next circle of punishment? Well, it's the legal one, where you get thrown in jail, and then they come out of jail, and it's just a continual circle. But, like you were saying about the cocaine in school, I don't think I've ever seen anyone snorting cocaine in school, but definitely... marijuana is prevalent in our county, and I'm sure quite a few people at our school, in fact, I know quite a few people at our school, do smoke marijuana. But this goes back to the harm reduction. Zero tolerance isn't a harm reduction, I don't think, because even if they want to smoke pot, then they leave campus and they go smoke pot somewhere else. It's zero tolerance doesn't help them, it just punishes them.
But then it doesn't even punish them. It sends them home so they can go sit on their couch and smoke weed. I mean, it makes them more comfortable while they're smoking weed.
It's not even a good punishment.
It doesn't show them the error of their ways. It just shows them that they're going to be able to smoke way more weed if they get in trouble.
And that's one of the ways that harm reduction is better than zero tolerance in our schools.
Precisely. Yeah. You see, with zero tolerance, it's the equivalent of zero tolerance equals one strike and you're out. I mean, Our country is essentially founded on baseball. I mean, we have the three strike system with prison, with jails and prison, you know. But with schools, we have one strike and you're out. And now we're children. Now can't you be a little more lenient with children? Can't you teach them, or do you, must you force them into being punished just for messing up once?
You think about this. Relating to this baseball, you start with T-ball. In T-ball, there is no striking out. You just hit the ball and you go for it. You see, baseball works the exact opposite of our system, where we start off with this one-strike rule, where you do something bad, you get in trouble. And as we go, we have a three-strike system. You know, you can steal a candy bar from a store, get caught three times, you get sent to prison. So that's three strikes, and say we have one strike, and it's like the opposite thing. You know, what would it be like if we started with, like, little kids getting, you know, pitching the ball and a baseball bat having to, like, swing? And I think that wouldn't get very, you know, good results.
What was I going to say? Oh, so Talon was talking about getting suspended from, not you personally getting suspended from class, but suspensions from class earlier, and that one of the things that the teachers can suspend a student for pretty much any time they want is willful defiance, or, let's see, where is it? What was the word?
That singular word, man. It's
I don't know. Anyway, we talked about it earlier. Any willful defiance, they can use that anytime they want. If you're in class and you're sitting there and you've had a bad day and the teacher's, I don't know, teaching some kind of multi-divisional...
something insane,
economistic view of a piece of literature, and you're done, and you have so many other things to do in the following periods, and you just want to work on those things, and the teacher comes up behind you, and they're like, what are you doing? And, oh, I'm sorry, I need to get this done. They're like, you can't do that. Either do this right now, or I'm suspending you from class, and they can do that. And, Talon, didn't you say that in the charter school, that if you get suspended three times, you can get expelled?
Oh, in any school, usually.
Oh, really?
If you get suspended enough times, yeah, you'll get expelled, and that's just how it is.
Different schools have different, set up limits for you get suspended, you know, this for this, or you have any suspensions, it is until an expulsion.
And that's just crazy. Like, if you're in class three times, just working on other things, and they suspend you all three times, you can get expelled from your high school.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it works with charter school, but with Laneyville High School, that's definitely in effect.
So do you guys, when students do get suspended, do we get any counseling? Is it mandatory? What happens?
No, you see, I've been suspended before, but they never tried to give me any help. They just told me I had to go home and spend a couple days at home and come back. Now, they essentially viewed it as a cool-off period. You know, you go home, you cool off, you don't get to do any work, you fall behind in your grades. Everything in your life sucks after that. No, you don't get any help after that. It's just they punish you, and they expect it to be a punishment. But really, all it is, it's something that hinders your future. And that's what a punishment is supposed to be, but that's not what you should do with kids. We're kids. We need help. We don't need explosions, suspensions. We don't need this. We need actual help.
There's like no constructive criticism, kind of, when you're suspended. Like if you're suspended and you're pulled out of school, sure you lose the time in class. You lose some homework. You have to make up. But if you're suspended on like a weekly, monthly basis, that doesn't matter. Because potentially you're in class not doing anything still, you don't do your homework, and it doesn't matter. There's no help for you.
Yeah, I mean, even like authors have editors. Like when they make a couple mistakes in their writing, editor goes through, they fix it, they clean it. You know, but we don't have that in schools. Like they're trying to teach us to be writers, but we don't get to have the perks of, you know, an editor. We need that. We need the constructive criticism from our schools.
There's such a thick punishment culture in America. Like I was on the prison construct. I forget that word every time I think about it. Anyway, I was on the prison show a couple months back, and we were talking about how when you go to prison, there's no counseling for you, there's no rehabilitation. You go to prison and then you come out, and it's again the circle of punishment. Well, schools are kind of the same with the zero tolerance policy, where there's no help for you. It just, if you do these bad things and continue doing these bad things, then you will be suspended and you will be expelled, and there's no one there to help you. Yeah. Which is a really sad thing.
Yeah, like, oh man, yeah. Okay, well, are we ready to open the phone? No?
Let's keep talking. I know lots of kids who get stuck in the exact same situations again and again and again, and they keep on getting in trouble. You know, there's the, you know, fighting. It's like, you know, if you get her, like, you know, just a generally disliked person, then people can fight with you, and then they can say that you started it. And you know, it's like these kids at my school who, if something bad happens, everyone will blame it on them because they can take the blame, and they just assume it's that person because, you know, they just are that type of person. They just get in trouble, and they get suspended and, you know, maybe expelled, and, you know, they could have nothing to do with it, but it's still, you know, we don't have a good setup system for, you know, even tracking down the trouble that happens in schools. You know, like we like in the real world, we have like detectives and like fingerprints, kind of, but in, like, schools, it's just like you have to guess who did it. Or eyewitnesses who can be lying to you. You have no idea. You have no proof of anything.
Yeah, you have a bunch of kids pointing the finger at a
bunch
of kids.
Really, it shouldn't be treated like the same system that we have now.
Like, maybe this problem child is only a problem child because there's no one there to help him or her. And that's sad.
Yeah, and then we don't even consider maybe, you know, helping them. Yeah, that wouldn't be a bad thing to do if they haven't had any help. Maybe they need it.
And of course, you know, our society says that being helped is unmanly, and so that in itself will cause many problems with the male populace to get help, because they want to be manly and tough, and crying in the corner is not a good thing.
Is there any problems you guys think that are exhibited by marijuana use in our schools?
Laziness.
Laziness?
Yeah. We have a lot of really lazy
increased people. Hunger.
We have a lot of cutting in lines. It's really annoying. The lunch line, if you wait, you never get your food.
Yeah, man, never.
It's a problem. Ever. It's terrible.
Everybody looks glazed, kind of like donuts.
It's true, though. It's really true. Like it sounds funny, but it's they're actual
lack
problems.
Lack of concentration in class, yeah, not trying to, you know,
I think the only one I could pin down would be lack of concentration in class. And that can be really hard when you have a good half of a class who's really into what's being taught right then, and then the other class, there's just no input, and that can really just bog down the learning environments pretty completely.
Yeah.
So that would probably be the only direct.
Yeah.
And the use of the word bro, it really annoys me. Yeah, bro, let's go over here, man,
yeah,
bro.
It's a direct
bro,
effect
dude,
of marijuana consumption.
It's a direct effect, I swear.
Yeah. No.
Also,
go for it.
Also, I would say, truancy, isn't that being like late for class?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like truancy and being late for class could definitely be another con from our marijuana culture in our schools, because they go off campus to go smoke, and then they come back, and they have to come back to school, and that makes them late, and that just, once again, disturbs the learning environment. So being late and then being unfocused.
Yeah. Now, with willful defiance, you know, I was about to phrase that incorrectly, I'm sorry. Allow us to move on to another subject. Okay.
Willful defiance. Let's stick with that subject. Okay, with willful defiance, we have people, you know, it's basically just disagreeing with somebody and saying, no, I'm not going to do that because I can use my time better. Mm-hmm. And I'm right, you're wrong. I have authority. And it fits in with our, we have a male stereotype that, you know, you have to be a man, grow up, be a man, you know, you've got to be masculine, strong,
oh, man.
In charge, and,
now you're
you know,
man.
Everybody else is, bull-
man,
you've got to, yeah,
man.
It, you know, it's not a, you know, you have a very, you know, strict thing, you've got to follow this, you have to, you know, laugh at the right things, be strong, stupid, and it's this really silly, you know, stereotype we have set, and this willful defiance thing is part of it, because part of it is being able to take control of yourself and be charge of the situation at hand, and not have to listen to people of authority because you're right, and it fits into our male a stereotype of, you know, what a man should be. It's
be in control, where the school is the male stereotype, and they have to keep complete control over the students. And one of the things that I'm pretty amazed about is the amount of rights we lose when we do go to school, and how, like, the searches and seizures and...
No, that applies to us at school. We get searched, they can search us. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, we lose so many rights when we go to school. And, again, I could see how that can be a necessity with, like, I don't know, firearms and stuff, but like, if you park your car on school property, they're allowed to search it, just everything.
Yeah, it doesn't apply to you. It makes you feel kind of uneasy, you know? It just makes you feel like... Yeah, it makes you feel violated in a way.
Yeah, your personal property.
Yeah, but the thing is...
You can't control it.
That, well, you... people, before they turn the age of 18... don't actually have the full rights of a citizen, because they aren't 18. They don't get to vote. Just as an example, it basically comes from that. You know, your parents are in charge of you. Anything you do wrong, they take the blame for you. It's like you know, and when you go to school, the idea is that your parents are giving their authority over you, they're, you know, in charge of you, to the school, so that they can take care of you in a proper manner, which is the idea of giving parents complete control over you. And so that's the idea behind it. Besides, you know, with parents, it's like a loving, holding grasp. You know, they care for you. You're their, you know, child. And with the school, you're just another kid. Yeah. So it's a little off, in my opinion. But yeah, I think it should be different in how it works.
Definitely, definitely. So we've discussed a pretty wide variety of topics. Now we're going to open the phone lines. The phone number is 456-9991. Everyone is welcome to call, and we'd especially like to encourage the youth, their parents, and concerned friends in the listening audience. Please call in if you have questions or insights about harm reduction or zero tolerance. Do you think that harm reduction is an adequate approach to protecting young people from the negative effects of drugs like marijuana and alcohol? How would you recommend that young people having difficulties from substance use be helped?
Can the concept of harm reduction be applied to the problems of bullying and school violence? What do you think of the concept of zero tolerance in schools? Is suspending or expelling students a form of harm reduction for the other students? What will become of the thrown away students?
What do you think about Mendocino County leading the state in the rates of suspension? State education law requires suspension for willful defiance. This counts for 40% of all suspensions. Can you think of a way to reduce these suspensions? Please join this discussion about harm reduction and zero tolerance. Please call in soon and be part of this conversation. The phone number is 456-9991. When you call, please be ready to turn down your radio, or we will get a very confusing echo. The number is 456-9991. Please call and share your opinions. This show ends at 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock. We'd really like to hear from you.
Yeah, singular, not plural.
Wow, we're popular. You're on the air.
Hey, howdy. You guys are really cool. You've got really cool minds and warm hearts. I really understand what you're saying, man. You kicked me out of school for going to study hall from the library without a pass, you know?
Wow, man.
It's a cool Nazi police state where we're under, like, such... We have no rights anywhere. The whole Fourth Amendment's been destroyed. I've been living my whole life in a terrorist police state, waiting for them to take my marijuana and my car and put me in jail or whatever. It's just totally crazy. I'm really into your harm reduction. That's an awesome concept, you know? Another thing I thought about, kids in school. What about this deal of Ritalin, where they're giving all these kids, they say, oh, you have attention deficit disorder. We're your doctors, and we're going to prescribe you our drugs. And they're really bad drugs, those selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They're terrible when you come down off them.
Yeah, Ritalin, nothing
crazy
all that.
Stuff going on out there. I appreciate you guys a lot. So, you know,
Thank you.
Yeah, you guys are awesome. This is Vegan Dan out here, you know. I gave you a buzz before. You guys are awesome.
Thanks, man.
We'll let some other people get to you.
Okay.
Great. Have a good day, man.
You're on there.
Yeah, hello. I just wanted to call in because I was a kid in high school who was expelled due to zero tolerance rules. It wasn't in the state of California. It was our dear neighbors in Arizona. I just wanted to call in and, you know, give my two cents that it really, it definitely doesn't help the student who is being expelled. As in my experience, I was expelled my junior year out of high school from my entire school district and really just left to fend for myself.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty messed up.
I didn't finish high school, and I actually wound up, I'm about 30 years old now, and I'm just sort of picking up the pieces from where I didn't get to finish high school, and there was really no other options for me, so I started working full-time and, you know, without a direction and, you know, sort of that sort of within that comfort net of being in school, I was sort of just kind of kicked out into the world at 16 years old, and I wound up doing a lot more drugs than I think I probably would have had, you know, I had, you know, proper counsel and a direction under the guise of school, because, you know, my parents didn't have the money or the resources to fight my expulsion, and, you know, I wound up living a pretty hard life in the early side of my teens, or the later side of my teens and the early part of my 20s. And I think a lot of that would have been due to me just sort of being completely left to fend for myself as a 16-year-old.
For sure.
Yeah, that's a direct example of them enforcing inadequate laws, you know. Expelling somebody when they're 16 from an entire school district, your family can't move all the time. Like, that's
crazy,
that's
honestly.
Messed up, man.
Yeah, it really is. That, like, when you don't... And I remember at my expulsion hearing, I mean, I was just a kid, and I sat down at this table with administrators from the school district and probably about a dozen lawyers that they had on their team.
Oh,
and,
man.
I mean, the expulsion hearing, it lasted all of about 15 minutes. And, you know, they told me that I could speak my case if I wanted to, but of course it was like I didn't know how to prepare. I don't know legal recourse. I'm a 16-year-old kid. My parents didn't have the resources to get a lawyer.
Yeah.
So we basically just sat down at this hearing. You know, it felt like draconian. You know, it was like a total like witch hunt style thing. They made me out to be this evil kid, and they just like that just sort of took, you know, an easier chance at a better future away from me. And I think I was pretty bitter about that for a long time, but...
I can see why.
Then the other side of the argument is, does it help the other more focused kids in the school? Because I was, you know, messing around, partying, smoking weed and stuff when I was in high school, and that's what I got caught for. It was just pot. I mean, it was like a tiny, tiny amount of pot, too. And that got me out of my entire district. So I think it's, there's some, you know, the administrators that be need to take a serious look at what they're doing and how it affects the kids that they're doing it to. Because the fact of the matter is, they are just kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They really are, yeah.
I mean, how evil can we be when we're 16?
Pretty evil, but I mean, it's totally. Just like...
Hitler was 16 once, too.
To need to be away from all of the other kids.
Yeah,
I just don't believe it. But yeah, thank you guys for your show, and
thank you for your input.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, you're on the air.
By golly, I got through. That's great. I'm probably about 2 years shy, about 60 years old, and I've known a lot of teenage folks in high school and stuff, and a whole lot of them have gotten in, you know, stupid, kind of stupid trouble that they weren't thinking about. And I kind of tend to, like, do a little bit of counseling with, you know, friends and family. It's like, listen, you know, you're going to probably go to juvenile hall for whatever you just did. But if you don't want to get involved in the legal system when you're, like, 18 or 21, you got to stop. Because once they have you in the computer, they're going to look at certain situations that are like, let's go talk to that person.
Yeah, they'll immediately finger you whenever they think something wrong happened, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've known a lot of people that actually have, like, been, you know, kind of rounded up going, well, okay, where were you and what were you doing and what, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And what? It's like, but the whole thing is that if you really care about kids and whatnot, which I do, you know, you got to talk to them and say, look, if you want to go ahead and play the legal game, you know, once you're 18, once you're out of school, they're going to have you. You know, they're going to have you. You can vote, maybe. But other than that, they're just going to keep looking at you and keep looking at you, and you want to live your life like that.
Yeah.
Because you've got a lot better opportunities, you know, going on for whatever you are doing. And I really think it's important that, you know, kids realize the fact that the legal system is not going to let up, and they won't do it.
Yeah, it's not gentle
once
on you.
They got you. They got you.
Oh, yeah.
And if there's something that fits your profile, which is high howdy profiling again, you know, they're gonna come look at you. They're gonna come and talk with you and go, well, where were you? What were you doing? Da 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 da. And so my advice basically to all young folks, especially high school kids, is, you know, really think about what you're doing. And think about it. And I don't care if you're smoking pot or if you're out drinking or what at a party or what, but think about what the consequences are if you get captured by these folks, because they're not going to let it go, and they're gonna make it like stick. And once you get stuck, you're stuck, and it's not a good way to live in this country. I mean, you're better off is like just, you know, kind of staying under the radar, I think.
Oh yeah.
But you know, my whole thing is rule number one: don't get captured.
It's a very good rule, yes.
Seriously, but, you know, I just wanted to put it out. It's like, hey, howdy, you know, it's like, you got to think about it. You really, I mean, because other than that, you're just going to, it's going to be miserable for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Or at least until you're like 30 or 40 or something like that. But it's like, you really have to stop and think about it. And I've helped quite a few kids just with talking with them because they're like friends and family.
And that's all we need. We just need to be talked to. And we need somebody who can understand. Yeah.
It really is the conversations. You guys are doing great. But I really think that, I know. I was, you know, when I was there, boy, I was like, yeah, you betcha. Let's go for it.
Yeah.
it's just something that needs to get looked at. And it really has to have the long-term consequences that have to be really considered if you want to have, pretty much of a normal free life and or lifestyle, you know, after you're done with the institutional processing that they put us all through.
Understanding is just so much.
I really think, you know, it's just think about it. Rule number one,
yes.
Don't get captured. Just
thank you very much.
Don't goof, you know, just don't goof it that bad.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your input.
Hey, I love your show. And thank you guys.
Yeah, have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Dude. Oh, look at that. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. I'm very much happy with what you guys are doing because I'd like to tie it together. Staying out of trouble, soot, S-O-O-T. How do you stay out of trouble? Stay out of trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you've got to do what you've got to do, don't do it on school grounds. 420, 410, you know, 310 is not that long. Go to school, apply yourself, learn, use that facility, educate, and party, you know, at school. Music, you haven't talked about music, poetry.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many depths of understanding and consciousness that come with alertness. And I've been a pothead for many, many years. I'm 66, 67 now. But I feel like it's kept me off alcohol. I've never done meth. I've never done heroin. I've never done half the other drugs that are out there. You know, anything. I've not I'm happy with herb. Herb is.
We're kind of running out of time here.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt you, but
Ritalin. The guy talked about Ritalin, and we need jobs. We need to talk about real issues. The amount of money that is spent on incarceration is ridiculous. Free education for every student. In my dream. Should graduate with $10,000 so that they can have first and last month's rent, education, tuition, books,
beautiful,
a car.
Beautiful.
We we've got
those are great ideas. Unfortunately, we're running out of time here.
We're just out of time, but thank you so much for calling in.
We got to sign out. That's all for this month's edition of Youth Speaks Out. Your hosts today have been me, Royce.
Me, Talon.
And me, Teo.
Laytonville Healthy Start Coalition's Drug-Free Communities Project is proud to support this month's Youth Speaks Out. Our Environmental Prevention Strategies in the Community, also known as EPIC, is a project funded by the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Through our organization and coalition, we are working towards reducing youth substance abuse through a variety of strategies in the Laytonville community. If you are interested in learning more about our efforts, please contact Laytonville Healthy Start at 707-984-8089 or email jama@jamashields@pacific.net.